From their studio in the Feeding Arizona building in Youngtown, Arizona, it's the Boomer and the Babe Show with Pete Peters and Deborah Brown. Join Pete and Deborah and their guests as they give voice to 78 million baby boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Now here are the Boomer and the Babe, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
Yes, and good morning. It is Monday, September 17th, 2012. And we are broadcasting from our offices in Sun City, Arizona. And I'm Pete Peters. Deborah Brown is out with clients today, and she's out busy making some inroads into the publishing aspect of our own as far as what we do with mini books and our e-books that we publish for people. We invite you to go to boomerandthebabe.com and take a look at everything else that the Boomer and the Babe are involved in. And that's at www.boomerandthebabe.com. And while you're there, please sign up for our online magazine, Boomer Experience Speaks. We're going to be coming up with our new one here in the next several days. We're just putting in the finishing touches on it pretty much as we speak. And I am Pete Peters, as I mentioned, and we're kind of waiting for our guest to come online. She's not come in online yet, so we're going to wait for her for just a few minutes, and rather than just sit here with some dead air, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the Arizona Boomer Radio Show that we do Monday through Friday at 9 o'clock West Coast time, noon East Coast. Today we had a great show with Mr. Ken Plotsky from AV Homes Incorporated, talking about new development in the active adult living development here in the Estrella Mountain area in Arizona. So if you're interested in knowing a little bit more about maybe taking a look at retirement homes in Arizona, you might want to listen to that show. That took place this morning at 9 o'clock. And in addition to that, we have some other guests that we have coming up tomorrow. We're going to have somebody talking about some other women's issues with regard to upset and turmoil and getting yourself put back together if you had issues along those lines. But right now what we're going to do, we're going to take the next 3 minutes. I'm going to play our advertising card that we have, and we're going to see what happens in the course of these 3 minutes, whether or not our guest shows up. And we'll be back after that, and we'll make a determination while you listen to these messages.
The Boomer and the Babe are the publishers of Boomer Series books. Our authors have their own shows on the Boomer and the Babe Network. We encourage you to listen. Ron Naraki, author of the forthcoming book, The 10 Commandments of Investing, is the host of Wealth DNA, a financial show about real estate investment. Learn how to build and manage your portfolio. Ron hosts the show, and he always has good information to pass along, as do his guests. Listen to Wealth DNA on the second and fourth Monday of the month at 8 a.m. Arizona time. Tom Lingering's another Boomer Series author. His book, Success or Failure, The Choice is Yours, is the basis of the show he does with his broadcast partner, Dr. Terry Munther. Listen to Success or Failure with Tom and Terry on the fourth Wednesday of every month at 9 a.m. Arizona time. Learn how you can maximize your performance in business and in life. The methods you employ can either help or hinder. The choice is yours.
Hey folks, John Bloom here. When I'm not broadcasting for the Cardinals or Suns, I've been spending the last couple of years with my friends building the fastest growing online golf community in the great state of Arizona. Before you book your next round of golf here, go see what golfers just like you are saying about the courses you want to play at golfmix.com. You'll get the most authentic feedback from golfers giving you information you need before you spend the money you've earned. While you're there, write a review of the last course you played and get $10 off your next purchase at Vans Golf Shops, and enter into the Greenskeeper of the Year contest for a chance to win a foursome at the home of the Waste Management Phoenix Open, the stadium course at TPC Scottsdale. Please join us for the next Golf Mixer, Saturday, October 6th at the Raven Golf Club at Verado, and play a hole with PGA Tour winner Aaron Overholser and World Long Drive champion Brian Pavlett. You can find details on golf mixers, tournaments, charity events, junior golf, and more on our statewide golf events calendar. Just check out Golf Mix, Arizona's leading golf course review site and mobile app. What are you waiting for?
Get in the mix!
At golfmix.com.
The Boomer and the Babe are proud to be affiliated with Valley View Community Food Bank, where the food is always free. Valley View is now serving Phoenix from their new 36,000 square foot location at West Peoria and 107th Avenue in Sun City, Arizona. The new location houses the food bank, Feeding Arizona, and the Valley View Thrift Store. Feeding Arizona delivers food to other food banks and food pantries that are in need. If you're looking for a 501c3 to support, go to valleyviewcommunityfoodbank.com. All donations are welcome, be it food, money, or volunteer hours. No donation is too small. Get a hold of Jesse Ramirez, founder and director, and say, "I want to help." Valley View Community Food Bank, where the food is always free.
And we are back with the Boomer the Babe Show, and I see that we have our guest online now. She is Delilah Devlin. She has published more than 50 erotic stories in many lengths and genres, and we're going to talk to her about authorship and publishing and all kinds of interesting things, and we'll welcome her to the show right now.
Doing?
Hello. Hello, Delilah. Are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. We've got you just fine, loud and clear. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for coming in and visiting with us.
Thank you.
What we normally do as we get going, Delilah, is we ask our guests for their, what Deborah would call if she were here, your two-minute movie. Just a little background of you know, what you've been up to prior to becoming a best-selling, wonderful writer, publisher, and author. So what is there? What is the background on Delilah Devlin, and how did you get started in your literary career?
Oh, good Lord. Well, I spent a lot of time in the military, about 14 years active duty and another 7 in the Guard. And when I got out, I had 2 or 3 different careers, and I ended up in 2000, it was actually December 31st at midnight, sitting in an IT company that I was working in, and my sister was there with me at the time. She writes as Myla Jackson and L. James, and we both kind of looked around at midnight when, you know, the world was supposed to end for Y2K and said, is this really what we want to do for the rest of our lives? And we decided, no, we want to do something fun, and we thought about, well, what are our talents? And we decided then and there we were going to be romance writers.
Just like that.
Just like that, yeah.
And you started writing romance stories. What was the first one you wrote?
The first one we wrote was called Sophie's War, and it was kind of, you know, they always tell you to write what you know. And so we started off with a woman who was in the National Guard and preparing to go to war, and by the time we finished with it, it was nothing like what we thought it would be at the start, you know, because we thought we'd do something serious or whatever, but we kept putting in little incidents that had happened to us while we were in our careers, and it turned out to be a comedy, and it was awful, but we put together 3 chapters, sent it out, got 5 requests for full manuscripts from publishers, and then we had to sit down and write the rest of the book, and of course it was rejected, but we caught the bug at that point.
Well, it's sort of like we do talks from time to time about people that have gotten themselves into business, and it's sort of like yesterday I couldn't even spell entrepreneur, and now I are one.
That's exactly right. Now, we started writing, and we entered a lot of contests, took a lot of classes, went to conventions, and eventually we learned how to do it. And I published for the first time with an e-publisher, Laura's Cave, in 2003. And a couple of years later, I sold to Avon and had my first print books out. So ever since then, I've just been a writaholic. You know, I love what I do. I couldn't imagine any other career. And I'm hoping I'll be like Barbara Cartland in writing until I'm 100.
There you go. Do you find that you have a formula? I mean, is there a formula for writing a good romance novel?
Well, you always have the ingredient of you've got to have characters that, even if you don't like them at the start of the story, you have to make them empathetic. So you always have to have empathetic characters, and with romances, you always have to have a happy ending. So if that's a formula, that's what it is. But I try not to make every book, you know, alike, you know, just, you know, by changing the the characters' names and where the setting is for the book. I try to make it a lot more different than that.
So, and you say it has to have a happy ending, because without a happy ending, there's no romance. Is that
exactly? You know, people who read romance stories want to come away feeling uplifted.
Now, is there a difference between a romance story and erotica?
There is, and there are erotic romances as well. But a romance story is more about the couple's emotional journey. It doesn't have to have any sex in it at all. An erotica story is more about the journey a person goes to learn about themselves through the sex. And when you have an erotic romance, you have a romance where the couple comes together through the sex. And so it's a part of the story. It's not something that, you know, you could strip out the sex scenes and have a story without the sex. It's integral.
I see. Now, what I've heard the term bodice ripper. And when I hear the term bodice ripper, I get the picture of this long-haired blonde guy. Was it Fabio?
Fabio,
On the cover, with his shirt open to the navel, and with this lustful look in this buxom woman in his arms.
Oh, yeah. Those are the stories I started reading. I loved them. And I don't, you know, a lot of romance writers today take great offense to having their romance novels called bodice rippers, but I loved them.
Is the term bodice ripper a particular genre of?
No. It's kind of a derogatory term that was affixed to romance novels. Romance has had a hard time reputation-wise in the writing industry. You know, everybody was making money writing romances, and romances were the biggest part of the market. But anybody who was a serious writer would, you know, turn up their nose at anybody who was writing romance. And so bodice ripper, you know, has always been kind of considered a derogatory term.
Oh, so it would be
right.
So it would go along the lines of, oh, you just write bodice rippers.
Right. Right.
It's kind of said with a sneer, is that?
Yes. But I don't mind. And in fact, when people, you know, some erotica writers don't like to have their books called smut, but, you know, I write smut. I like writing smut.
Everybody needs a little smut in your life anyhow, right?
Exactly.
So what do you think has caused romance novels, erotica, erotic romance, to become so popular? It seems to be enjoying a tremendous increase in popularity. What do you attribute that to?
I think everybody needs some good news. You know, and you, because of that formulaic happy ending that you always have to have at the end of a romance novel, you're guaranteed to be uplifted and to be, you know, to feel like there's hope in the world, you know, when you finish a romance novel. So I think that's part of it. But then it's become more acceptable for a woman to be caught, you know, reading a romance novel on a train when she's on her commute to work. And even more so recently, erotic romances, you know, what with the popularity of Fifty Shades of Grey, I mean, everybody's reading it. I even had a woman who told me that a man in her church was talking to her about the book. So, you know, it's becoming very mainstream.
What does it take for a good erotic romance novel to cross the line to become pornographic and pornography?
Some of it has to do with the language. We don't want, you know, the purple euphemisms they used to use in romance novels. We want everything to be explicit, but we don't want it to be overly crude. You know, so when you're talking about, you know, the physical aspects of the sex itself, don't go overly into, you know, the scents or the fluids or the, you know, the things that might be considered a little bit crass. You want to have emotions involved with it, too, so that it's not just a sex scene from a man's point of view, which would be, when we're writing them, like the Penthouse articles that you read that are
right.
All about the sex, and it's very crude in his point of view. You want to have some emotion being built up between the characters so that there's a hint of, you know, yes, this is lust, but, you know, he's actually a good person, and maybe there's a hope for romance in this.
So there is definitely character development. I mean, it's not something that you just throw it on the paper and see what shakes out.
Right, because if you don't have characters that they like and a couple that they can root for, a reader is going to be bored or be turned off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, do your romance novels typically have a good guy and a villain and some of the typical stuff that you might hear or read of in other types of literature?
Well, a story is a story, and you still have the same. You still need the same character roles. You need a protagonist that you can root for. In romance novels, you're lucky because you can have two protagonists. You can have the hero and the heroine with their own separate story intertwining throughout the tale. You don't have to have a villain, but it does make it interesting if there's something they're fighting against together. But, yeah, you still have the same story journey in a romance novel that you would have in any other genre fiction.
And that villain may not be not necessarily a person. It might
be... I teach a class, a plotting boot camp, and I talk about the fact that, you don't even have to have more than one person in a story in order to have all the character roles taken care of. I mean, if you think about the movie Castaway with Tom Hanks,
mm-hmm.
the movie was basically, he was the only person in the movie, and he
right.
was the protagonist to that movie. But he had Wilson, the soccer ball, that was his sidekick, who provided him a sounding board for all of his issues and his problems. You can have a story and just have one character.
Yeah, and after all, Clint Eastwood had a chair.
Mm-hmm.
So as you're developing your story, your book, how long does it take you? You indicated earlier that you're a pretty prolific writer, and by looking at, I see all these titles that you're associated with. How long does it take you to, from start to finish, put one together?
It really depends on the story and how firm an idea I have in my mind when I start. I have written full-length novels in 5 weeks. I typically write a novella in 2 to 3 weeks. I can write a short story in a day or a weekend. But sometimes I've written novels that, I started off, wrote the first 3 chapters and set it aside until I knew the story well enough that I could continue it, and it took 4 years to finish that book. So I generally tend to have 2 to 4 projects ongoing at the same time, so that if I get stuck in one story, I can leap to the next one and leap to the next one again if I get stuck, so that I'm always productive.
Do you ever find, as you have, let's say that you've got 3 or 4 going simultaneously and you're making this jump from one to the other, do you ever find aspects of one character starting to show up in another novel?
No. And I'm lucky that way. Some writers really have to focus on one story at a time, and they have a hard time jumping out of that world into the next world when they get ready to write the next book. But I walk around with daydreams in my head all the time, and they take different paths, and I try not to write the same genre, subgenre of romance at the same time. So if I'm writing a paranormal story, I might be writing a Western, and if I'm working on a paranormal and a Western and I go to a short story, then I want it to be another genre as well, so that I'm not mixing up my characters or that the worlds are distinct enough that I can jump into them and not get confused.
Gotcha. Now, we mentioned briefly, we touched on the acceptance of erotica and erotic romance and so on. Do you think and you mentioned also that you thought it was because people are looking for good news nowadays, they're looking for happy endings, and when you turn on the news, there really isn't a whole heck of a lot of happy endings as it seems to be going right now.
Right.
But do you find that people are more accepting of it, that the Internet has anything to do with it?
I think it does, too, because a lot of people who, years ago, when I first started writing, there were only, a few large publishers, and they were your only hope if you wanted to publish. And so you were also limited, the reader was limited, as to what they could find on the shelf when they went to buy books. And these days, there's just such a variety of books that are available, and you can read in the privacy of your home, download a book, and never have to walk into a bookstore and ask for something with a cover that, might embarrass you, that sort of thing. And I think it's just made it so much more accessible.
I think that may well have something to do with it. But I also, these are just my amateur psychologist, sociologist ramblings here. But do you think people are less inhibited publicly and therefore more willing to be seen with that book cover, that nasty book cover?
I do think there is a generational difference. If I think about my mother, she used to carry around paperbacks in her purse, but she always had book covers on them, you know, so that she would hide what it was she was reading at the time. And these days, I don't think younger people or even people of my generation have that much of, they don't care that much about what people see them reading.
Yeah, so I'm reading 50 Shades of Grey. So what, are you? You're not? Why not? What the heck's the matter with you? I mean,
yeah.
Now, Delilah, I've got to admit to you, I mean, I've got a 37-year-old daughter, and my 37-year-old daughter was saying that she's read all the 50 Shades of Grey books, and I went, okay.
Probably more than you wanted to know about what her life might be like, right?
There's certain things that dear old dad just doesn't need to know about his little princess, you know. But I mean, it's funny because Deborah's also I don't know if she's read them all, or she's certainly read the first one, and she started to read some of the others like, apparently, and whether she's completed them or not, she says, I don't know, but she did say that she thought for her likings it went too far. There certainly are a bunch of people reading it, and I think some men are reading that stuff too now, aren't they?
They are. And in fact, I have a Facebook account, and I have quite a few men who Facebook with me as well. So it's not, you know, just women who are reading the romances or the erotic romances.
Well, let's talk about some of the stories that you have written. I don't have the full list here in front of me, but what are some of them that that you're particularly fond of, or that have done well, or some, maybe even, if you want to call them favorites, for lack of a better word, what might some of those be?
I have a couple of favorites. You know, I've written over, I don't know, 120 stories that have been published, and among them, one of them was a series, well, it was part of a series that I wrote for Avon, the Dark Realm series, and the story in particular was Seduced by Darkness, and I loved the story because, number one, I was writing about vampires and werewolves and demons. The world was very rich in mythology. It really took a lot for me, research-wise, to put the stories together. Seduced by Darkness is the one that I said that I wrote in 5 weeks because once I got started with the story, it was magical. I didn't want to ever leave it. You know, I'd go to bed, I'd get out of bed early, I'd go to bed late because I wanted to be in that story world. And another one that I wrote more recently was Ravished by a Viking. And it's got the typical bodice ripper title, but it's Vikings in space. And I had a lot of fun with that as well because I was able to mix up the mythology, you know, and the history of the Viking people and what would happen if they had been, you know, kidnapped and taken as, you know, in their society, just transplanted to another world where they were enslaved. And so I had so much fun with those worlds that I'm fond of the books, and the readers who did find them love them as well and hope for more stories.
How do you come up with, I mean, those are just too fascinating to me. They're very fascinating settings. How do you come up with these things? I mean, do they just come to you like a bolt out of the blue, or?
Most of the time, stories like that do. A couple of years ago, I was getting ready to go to bed and turned off all the lights, and there was just a little bit of reflection in the mirror across the bed from me. And I was just starting to dream, and all of a sudden I thought I saw a handprint in the mirror. And so I get up and I turn on the lights, you know, because I'm always, you know, spooked by things like that. And I'm looking at the mirror and I'm thinking, what if there was a handprint, but it was on the inside of the mirror? And then it starts the idea. I had to get up, of course, and I was up till 2 o'clock in the morning making notes. And I was calling another writer friend of mine saying, hey, it's time, we need to take a road trip because I think this story is set in Memphis. And that particular book is going to be coming out in January, and it's called Shattered Souls. And it's a paranormal that's light on the eroticism, but it's kind of a police drama cross with paranormal. And it was a lot of fun to write, too. But, yeah, sometimes those things come as dreams, as bolts. When I was writing the paranormal, the vampire story, I wrote a treat. I love New Orleans. It's one of my favorite cities, and I'd been there several times. And I wrote a story that was set in New Orleans at a time right after a huge storm wiped out the city. I mean, it pretty much flooded it, graveyards, you know, the coffins in the graveyards were rising up, that sort of thing. I tried to sell that book, and it just, you know, bombed with I got reject. And then Katrina hit.
Oh, my.
So I ended up, you know, 2 months later contracting for that book.
Wow. Wow. Sometimes fate deals you the cards. How much research do you do? I mean, typically speaking, how much research do you do? How in-depth do you do your research when you're looking in a particular genre?
When I write paranormal stories or I write futuristic stories, I do a lot more research because I am trying to pull in different mythologies, different histories. For the science fiction, the Viking story that I did, I had to do, you know, some research into physics and stuff so that I could figure out how things might work. But typically, I don't do a lot of research. I've traveled quite a lot, so I'm able to pull from my memories about, you know, setting locations, that sort of thing. If I write somebody who's in law enforcement, I might look up that local PD to see how they're organized and see, you know, where the substations would be so that I can include those details and make it authentic. But other than that, I just kind of, you know, go with the flow, you know, wherever my imagination leads me.
Well, what is the latest project you've been involved in is something called Cowboy Lust. Is that correct?
Cowboy Lust.
Okay.
Yeah. It's
well, I'm going to read something that your PR people sent me about it, this opening line. It's a quote from Lorelei James.
Yes.
Once you had a cowboy's boots under your bed. And a big, strong body keeping you hot every night, you'll never settle for anything less. I read that and I went, wow, what kind of discussion is this going to be today? So tell me about, not that I'm personally interested in cowboy lust, maybe a little cowgirl lust, who knows, but tell me about cowboy lust. Where is it set? What's it about? Without giving too much of it away, I'm sure you know how to do that. So, give us a little rundown on Cowboy Lust.
Well, I'm fortunate. I've been writing cowboy stories for a while. I lived in Texas for 9 years, and my backyard was right up against a working ranch. So, writing cowboys, I didn't have to do a lot of research. All I had to do was look out the back window, and I was there. But when it came time for me to pitch an idea to Cleus, they liked me to do anthologies for them, you know, go out and do a call for submissions and get authors in the genre to write the stories, and I do the first editing. I put my own story in there as well, and I put the volume together, and they publish it. And so when it came time to do this particular project, Cleus had wanted me to do a hetero romance collection with some sort of an iconic alpha male as the theme. And so we came up with Cowboys as the first one. It was a natural one for me. And I got a collection of stories from people all over the world. Anna Meadows wrote one that was based in Mexico. I had one from Cheyenne Blue from Australia. I had, of course, a bunch of American and Canadian cowboy stories as well. So I liked that I had a variety of settings, but I also had a huge variety of stories to choose from. So it wasn't like every story is going to be very different and very unique in the volume.
So how many contributors do you have to this?
I think it was 16 for that particular volume.
And are each of them considered to be
short
stories? Okay.
Yes.
So that makes them
Between like 2,000 and 4,500 words, and there's
okay.
like 15 or 16 stories in the volume.
Okay, and then do you edit them yourself?
I edit. I do the first round edits I figure out where I want the stories to be placed in the volume so that there's a natural flow, a rhythm, you know, so that when somebody sits down to read, they might start off with something that's maybe a little lighter, and I don't want to go from light to dark to light to dark and just, you know, hopscotch that way, but I want the stories to flow from one to the next so that it's like it feels like a journey by the time you've finished.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I do all that, then I send it to Cleus, and then they have their professional editors go through and do the line editing and the grammar checks and that sort of thing.
Oh, I see. So you edit for story. They edit for grammar.
They do the line editing, yes.
Yeah, okay. Very good. Very good. Now, are there any illustrations in these books?
No, other than the cover, which was a very sexy cowboy in the cover. It's strictly print.
Strictly print. Okay. And how long did it take you to develop that anthology?
The call for submissions, I gave authors about a month and a half to submit stories. And once I got all the stories together, I think I had a month to read through all the stories, make my selections, because I had quite a few, and I had to winnow it down to just the 15 or 16 that I got. And then I had to put it into the manuscript. So I think I took a month to do that before I sent it off to Cleus.
Well, how many, I mean, you ask for submissions. How many do you typically have to choose from amongst how many?
It depends. You know, writers are busy creatures, and sometimes they have lots of deadlines. So even if somebody is interested in submitting to a volume, they might not have the time to write a story. So I've gotten between 50 and 120 for a collection. I think for Cowboy Lust, I had about 100 stories that I had to go through. For Smoking Hot Firemen, which will be coming out next June, I think I got about 80.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I have quite a few stories I have to read in order to find the gems that I select.
Wow, that's amazing. Are there ever enough of them that you could get two anthologies out of the group?
Oh, yeah. I did a lesbian collection that was called Girls Who Bite, and I honestly had enough really fantastic stories that I could have done two volumes of Girls Who Bite.
Wow.
So it's a little frustrating because I know there's potential there, but the publisher, they understand what it is the market will support, so we did the one.
So the newest work is Cowboy Lust.
Cowboy Lust, yes, and it just came out in August.
Okay, well, why don't we just take this information here from you and tell us how people can get hold of Cowboy Lust and any of your other works.
Well, Cowboy Lust, if you just went out and Googled it, you'd be able to find it at Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and through the publisher's website as well. But if they want to check out my website, I've got links to all the books that I've written, and that's www.DelilahDevlin.com.
DelilahDevlin.com. Are all of your books available as e-books? Or
some of them are e-books, and some of them are print, and some are both.
Okay. Okay. Very good. Very good. Tell me what you think about the e-book phenomenon. Do you think it's an easier way for people to get? I mean, I know it's an easier way for people to get published independently, but I mean, is it something that that works just as well as a print copy? Do you think?
I think that prior to e-publishing, that, like I said before, the variety of stories that were available was very limited. And e-book publishing made everything very accessible. It made it easier for authors to find additional publishers or to self-publish their own stories. There are so many stories out there now that it's hard for a reader to find. It's like they have to know the author in order to be able to trust the quality of what they're reading.
Right, right.
And so, because it is so simple, I mean, anybody, absolutely anybody can publish. But I always, you know, when people are asking me, well, should I self-publish my book? And I'll say, well, what have you done to prepare it and to make sure that it's ready for publication? Because You want to make sure that the first time you go out the door and you have a story, that you, that it's one that will be memorable for a good reason. So you want
right.
to have it professionally edited. You want it to have a professional cover, and you want to be able to market it in a way that will help to bring it success as well.
What we do, we have some e-books that we help people get published. Deborah does that, and she does some of the editing and so on and so forth. And she also, we also have a little marketing package that we do for them. And what I think we find is that a lot of people are writing their first book as an e-book.
Yeah.
And we're trying to help them. Deborah's trying to help them get it as good as can possibly be gotten for the subject matter they're covering. And some of them are surprisingly good. And they need a little help, and she's a linguist, and she's a punctuation freak. And she does all those types of editorial-type things. Tries not to mess too much with their content because it's their story, after all.
Right.
But it's interesting because we put together a series that we call the Boomer Series, and it's written by boomers, stories about boomers or from boomers, and two boomers. So I mean, it's we've been told by somebody in the publishing industry that sometimes series sell real well because especially if you can find a niche that not too many other people are doing.
Right, and readers are coming to expect series from authors that they love.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really good hook. If you can write a story and have characters that you can have show up in the next stories and the next, they get invested in those characters. And so it's a really good sales tool. But also it helps you connect with your readership.
Yes, yes. So if they like volume one, then chances are they're going to see 2, 3, and 4.
Exactly. If they like the first one, they're going to be gobbling up the rest.
Right, exactly. Well, Delilah, I want to thank you again for spending a little bit of time with me this morning, this afternoon, depending on where people are listening, and good luck in your continued success as an author, as an anthologist, and all the other hats that you wear.
Well, thank you so much for having me today.
It's been my pleasure, believe me. Thanks again.
You take care.
Take care. You do the same. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And that was Delilah Devlin, author and anthologist of Cowboy Lust, amongst many others. 120 novels she's written, or 120 stories. Go to DelilahDevlin.com and see all of her work, and also available on Amazon, some of them e-books, some of them in hard copy. So we thank you for listening to our show this afternoon. We're going to be back again tomorrow with more fine guests, and we hope that you'll join us as well. So with that, we'll say goodbye. Have a great day, everybody, and we'll talk with you again tomorrow. Take care.
You've been listening to the Boom and the Babe Show, where we bring interesting conversation to the world. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, where we tweet as Boomer and Babe, and on Facebook as Pete Peters 47. As always, you can friend us on Blog Talk Radio or sign up for our newsletter at boomerandthebabe.com. Email us at host@boomerthebabe.com with any of your comments. Remember, at 50, you're just getting started.